This episode is brought to you in part by Swim. Here's the thing about wishlist apps. Most of them just sit there. A customer saves a product, and then nothing happens. Swim actually activates that data. When someone wishlists a product, you could trigger price drop or back-in-stock alerts and feed that intent directly into Klaviyo or your CRM. You're not guessing what people want, because they've told you. Plus, customers can share wishlists for gifts, and your team can view them to offer personalized service online or in-store. And unlike cart abandonment, wishlist data is permission-based. These are people raising their hand saying, "Hey, I want this, just not right now." Swim's been around for over a decade. It powers 45,000 stores and installs in about 5 minutes. You could try it for free today at getswym.com/Kurt. That's getswym.com/Kurt. On today's episode of the Unofficial Shopify Podcast, we're talking acquisitions and scaling and, well, the big money stuff that is really fascinating. Jeremy Horowitz is joining us, and he's got the experience. He spent a decade scaling Shopify Plus brands and apps, including Gorgeous, and, you know, some of those you may recognize, and then launched his own PE fund. All right, that's where the big money stuff comes in, as soon as I hear private equity. And he is attempting to acquire Shopify apps. But what's so fascinating is he has been building in public, talking about it via a newsletter and LinkedIn, and has finally picked one in a space and has, well, all kinds of contrarian hot take ideas that, of course, were catnip to a podcast host like me. I want to hear it. I want to learn from his experience on growing these apps and, well, spending quite a lot of money on them. So, Mr. Horowitz, Jeremy Horowitz, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on, Kurt. Really excited to be back. I think it's been 5 years since the last time we did a podcast together. So really excited to dive in. A lot has changed since, I think, 2021, 2022.
So. Yeah, wow. Sorry. That's a while ago. So all right, you acquired an app. Let's name that up front. What is this new acquisition?
Yeah, so about a little over a year ago, we acquired a Shopify app called Coco AI, which is WhatsApp marketing, all your campaigns, automations, and then an AI sales agent on the back end. We acquired it from a team out of Paris and then have been taking over and scaling it under our fund, Because Ventures, where the quick model is we either acquire $10 to $100 million Shopify brands and scale them up, or $1 to $10 million ARR SaaS businesses and scale them up as well. Essentially, everything is related to an e-commerce business, which at this point basically means a Shopify business.
And that's like, for your career, your adult experience, it's all e-com, isn't it?
99%. I started in an HR company in software out of college, and then started building Magento connections. And then from there, basically moved in. Like, how I got into Shopify was migrating sites off of WordPress and Magento onto Shopify. That was over a decade ago. And then, yeah, I haven't really looked back since then.
One of your early successes was a Magento store, I believe.
Ew.
But it was aftermarket automotive. That's my specialty.
Yeah. I feel like everyone in e-commerce, if you do this for long enough, you have to touch it. So essentially my partner who I started the fund with had done this before. So he acquired an automotive aftermarkets business. We scaled it up. And then almost 15, 20 years ago, two SaaS companies spun out of that model. So essentially what were the problems that what's called the platform business or the main business has? What's some software that we can solve those problems with? And then essentially we figured out other customers had it. Late 2018, 2019, all three of those businesses exited. And then we started the current fund, Because Ventures, to essentially replicate that model. So, you know, what's a really big brand that we can grow and we can scale? And then what are software businesses that other e-commerce brands will, have similar problems we can sell into similar models? And we essentially just reversed it this time where we bought the software business first.
So how long you were at Gorgeous leading ecosystem marketing, yeah?
About a year, 2 years ago now, I left Gorgeous where I ran a lot of their big marketing programs, especially on the partnerships and events social side. And then we started the fund again, where then, about a year of searching, we ended up acquiring the Coco as our first acquisition.
That I found fascinating. Like when you you know, you started writing about it online and you're saying, hey, you know, I'm looking for an acquisition. And you had a very clear picture in your head, it seemed, of like, well, this is what makes a good acquisition for us. You didn't just stumble into it. It sounded like it took you a lot of time. And didn't, geez, you look at hundreds of these things.
Yeah, it probably started in 2022. We were doing some early stage checks, like angel VC style checks. And then we were like, we don't really want to do this. This isn't a great fit for us. So we wanted to get back in. We started doing some sourcing and diligencing for other private equity firms. So, you know, we were like the e-com guys where a big private equity firm would be looking at a deal. They'd call us in to look at it. We kind of got that taste again of like, we want to do this again. And so, between my LinkedIn, which has been just a great, and the newsletter, which has been a great source of deals, I probably looked through about, now I'm probably close to 500. We probably looked through about 450 before we bought Coco. It's been an insane 5 years of looking at, like, you know, from the 2020 just surge to the collapse to now the, we'll call it the bumpy ride from here. We looked at a ton, mostly on the brand side. We looked at a lot of brands, especially in that like 10 to 100 mil range. And then, it all kind of came together through LinkedIn. The founders of Coco reached out to me being like, hey, we see that you're looking to buy software businesses. We talked, and then about 3-4 months later, we decided to acquire it, close on the deal.
And what was the, out of 500 deals, what's the thing that makes Coco, this WhatsApp, a WhatsApp app for Shopify merchants, what made that one stand out, you know, above the other 499?
Okay, where Coco fit was, it was a very contrarian bet that I was very bullish on. So if anybody's been listening to the podcast long enough, the last time I was on the podcast, I was kind of giving the playbook for how SMS marketing is working at the time, and like very early in the SMS evolution. You know, now everybody has as a channel in the States, it's a very popular channel. I kind of noticed from our research that it's the exact same thing in Europe and kind of honestly the rest of the world, other than North America and some, you know, Asian countries like China that had their own version of WhatsApp. Basically, everyone else in the world uses WhatsApp. And so the big insight there was, one, the app was just growing incredibly quickly. Like, I'd very rarely seen kind of zero to, I can't publicly disclose it, but zero to X scale of revenue. You can probably intimate based on our criteria in such a short period of time. The other piece was that contrarian bet of no, the rest of the world isn't really doing, there's no equivalent to SMS. WhatsApp is that channel. And we thought Coco was a great bet in that market. And then the third piece was, candidly, brands are just really hard to acquire right now. We can get into why, but with tariffs, with all of the other uncertainty.
Well, it sounds like excitement around AI and uncertainty around tariffs meant SaaS was the way to go. And it was just an easier bet, an easier sell at the time. And then within that, you know, just from my experience, WhatsApp is, you know, such an untapped opportunity in the US, whereas like all of Europe, this is the default. You know, Latin America, this is the default. The rest of the world is using WhatsApp and the US is catching up to it. And so I absolutely agree with you on your thesis that like, oh, you know, there's a big opportunity with this here. And then you've just coupled the excitement of AI to it to make investment, you know, a little bit easier, it sounds like.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, the business doubled last year. We're on pace to double again this year. So it was just like a, you know, our space is so hard because you have to have the perfect timing of when you acquire it to when it's going to grow to when you also exit it. The big difference of how private equity works and most people who are not VC style investors is VCs are like, okay, we're going to put a ton of money in. We just want you to go on a rocket ship. And that rocket ship can take 10, 15 years, sometimes longer. But we just wanted to see this thing go vertical versus the way our model works is two parts. One, we don't make 10 bets hoping one will work. We make two bets hoping and need two to work. The other part of that is we have a very defined timeline. Like our investors expect their capital back in the next 3 to 5 years. So it also has to be a market where, you know, the thing is growing. It doesn't need to be like 10x and go vertical year over year, but we do have to hit certain targets in the next, you know, from a year ago, 3 to 5, now it's really kind of 3 to 4 years where we have to get it to a certain place. We have to get it to also a place where it is, you know, sellable again, and we can return our capital to our investors.
And is it, you know, part of it is, you know, what the current market is. There are the the appetite, the demand for business acquisitions changes over time. And often, you know, I suspect it really is tied to what the current interest rate is. And when we had 0% interest rate over the pandemic, suddenly there were a lot more businesses being purchased, I bet.
Yeah, exactly. And we can get in, if you want to go, we can get into some of the crazy financial engineering and politely magic that some companies were doing where, you know, yeah, our returns are determined by how much equity is put into a business. So let's just say that a business is going to sell for $10 million. If we have to come $2 million in equity, like actual cash out of someone's pocket that we have to go raise from versus $5 million, if the business sells for $50 at the end of the day, a return on $2 million versus $50 is much better than a return on $5 versus $50. Right. Like probably a 25x return versus a 5x return, right? So our investor in one scenario is making 25 times their money or 5 times their money, right? And it's a very big difference for them. And then also our entire financials and mechanics are built on their return. So the way that we think about it is, right? And then the other portion of that, we can get into deal structures, but most of the time the balance that will come from debt or some other type of vehicle. And yeah, when your interest rate's zero, so your cost to get that $5 million or $8 million is zero, you can greatly change the mechanics. Where I know some deals where some brands were bought for zero equity and 100% debt because interest rates were so cheap. And the type of the risk appetite, surprisingly, is actually much higher, where I'm willing to give you a much higher valuation and buy a lot more deals where my interest rates are cheap because it's less risk for my business as the acquirer. I know that sounds crazy, but it's like very counterintuitive to how you think about a business, but it's a lot less risk because I need to go raise less equity, which is at risk, like, which is the risk for my business as a private equity investor. And so, yeah, when interest rates spike, the other component is also when you have a physical goods business, you have to buy inventory, which then is another layer of debt, right? That $10 million enterprise value of a business, most business owners also probably want $1 million or $2 million for the value of their inventory that's sitting that they sell to make the business worth that. Now I've got to go raise even more debt to go buy the inventory to make sure that all sells. And all of those mechanics greatly change the math and the calculus that we need to do of, is this a good investment? Is this a good investment for right now? And how are we actually going to go generate a return on buying this thing with all this inventory today, grow it, scale it, and exit it?
So I want to dive into your acquisition criteria because you've made it public, but walk us through it. You're evaluating a Shopify store. What are we looking at first?
Yeah, so we specifically are looking for profitable and businesses that have what are called EBITDA. You will also hear this referred to as net income or SDE, seller discretionary earnings. In English, just the actual profit at the end of the day that the business generates when you take all the sales and take out all the costs. And what we are looking for is a business that does about 1 to 10 million in that profit number, which usually correlates for the average e-commerce brand to about $10 to $100 million. In top line sales, assuming that the average e-com brand usually does about 10 to 15% in net profit for their top line. The other piece that we specifically look for, which is not standard, but something that's important to us, is that it's 50% direct to consumer. So this is essentially the majority of their sales come from Shopify. Why that's important to us is we've just been burned so many times by Amazon and retail businesses in our careers, that we like to have the majority come from channels that we know and we can control. That's also kind of our specialty. There are tons of acquirers that are looking for Amazon-specific businesses, retail-specific businesses. The really important thing that if you are looking to sell your business to always think through is, why is this a good fit for them, right? Like we look a lot of those, you know, 400X deals were a lot of Amazon, you know, 55% Amazon businesses or majority retail businesses. Great businesses, probably a good buyer for someone else. Just it wasn't a good fit for us. The second piece is we like weird businesses. So we don't want to get into, you know, the 1,000th yoga pant business or the 500 clean beauty brand, things like that. I'm sure as everyone who's watching this podcast knows, like every ad platform is getting more and more competitive. Our entire model is quickly and profitably growing something from, you know, point A to point B. Unless there's something incredibly, even if there is honestly something incredibly unique about a yoga pants business or something like that, like I've just seen too many of them. It's too competitive of a space. Whereas we like weird businesses. And we like businesses that have some unique angle to them that if we do need to go and spend a bunch of money on advertising, we can have something that really stands out. Preferably, though, it has some other, like, paid media is basically a foregone conclusion that it needs to have. But preferably, we like to see some other element that we can push in some other marketing channel. And that could be, you know, influencer, affiliate, SEO, things like that. Could also be B2B sales channels or, local retail arms like veterinarians or doctor's offices or local gyms. That is a different and diversified revenue stream that we can go grow it as well. Because, you know, every channel eventually gets too expensive to continue scaling in. So we're looking for that unique angle in a product that, you know, we wouldn't go to, you know, for the fitness and apparel brand, like, you know, we can't just go to any local gym and say, hey, we have yoga pants. It's not going to be a compelling new product for them that makes their business more valuable and wants them to buy our product.
Do you care why the seller is selling?
Absolutely. That's going to be one of the most important reasons. And honestly, I have, you know, done this hundreds of times now, is usually the worst answered question in the entire process. And it is probably the most, one of the, you know, top three most important answers to have prepared. The reason why is I can't tell you how, like, you are selling your baby. And like, I stepped in and I am CEO and operating Coco, like our first acquisition. So like, and I've started a whole bunch of companies. So I understand the process, but I can't tell you how many of these things fall through because someone's either like, they want to sell, but actually they don't want to sell, or they have these like clauses and components where, you know, they say one thing in the beginning of the process and it's really something else that's important to them at the end. And, you know, it is a game of poker. Like, you do need to decide when you want to reveal certain information. But yeah, I can't say how many deals we've also passed on because I asked, like, you know, why are you selling right now? What's the ideal transaction look like for you? What do you want to do after this? And they just don't have a clear answer. And it's just like, it's one of those things that, like, as you do it, it's really, really hard. But the deals that actually move very, very well, the founder has a very, very clear reason of like, hey, I'm looking to sell this. I'm looking to sell it by X event or X date. And we'd like to, you know, like, we're ready to move on to the next thing. Those deals I've always found are more successful, because the other piece that's really important if you've never gone through this experience before is expectation setting. You know, it's a little bit of, a lot of these scenarios are a bit of the world is your oyster. You know, I'm looking to sell my business. I'm hoping to get as much money for it as possible. I'm hoping to get everything I want out of it. You know, that's the seller's experience, the person who owns the business originally. The buyer's experience is like, I need to fit very, very, very specific criteria for this to work for me. That's also why we put our criteria out publicly, is I just want to be very like transparent. And also candidly for me, my selfish benefit is it just saves a ton of time of, you know, I can't tell you how many people are like, they see my LinkedIn bio and I get pitches to start a gym or a restaurant or like, you know, stuff that I have no business investing money in. And like really being clear of like, these are the important things to me, because the other piece also is like, this also just becomes an enormous negotiation of every point and every little thing needs to be negotiated. And so like setting the expectations of this is what I'm looking for, this is like what's important to me early on, is really, really important. Because the other side, from our perspective, we're looking through every single thing you do and you say. And from our, you know, downside protection, we used to make sure you're not lying to us. So, you know, if you say something is important to you over here, and then when we actually get like 3 weeks in or 3 months, well, God, I hope it's never 3 months into diligence, but some of those deals are more complicated. 3 months into diligence, and, you know, you said something 3 weeks ago that was this, and now it's actually this over here. You know, that's an enormous red flag for us, because these aren't public companies. This isn't like Gap validated, you know, legal repercussions of how you're representing your information. We essentially have to do this all based on, you know, what's said, what's in the data that we're presented. And so we're also looking through the through points of, okay, this answer, this, you know, the reason why they're selling is important to them. Does that match up to what they actually say and what they actually do? Because, you know, I can't tell you how many businesses I've looked at where someone basically ran the business as far as they could run it. They're kind of discounting it into the ground and they're just looking to dump it. And, oh, you know, there's so much growth potential to this thing. And, you know, I don't feel like I'm the right person. I can't tell you how many times I've heard that. And, you know, when we look at it and it's like, okay, that's clearly not the truth. And so it's one of those things from our side where we kind of have to assume the best and the worst in every deal, and the people in every deal of like, they're telling us the truth until, you know, they tell us so much that we stop believing them. And so having that answer really, really dialed in also explains why the one of my LPs loves to always ask this question. This business is so great. Why are they selling? Right. And so you need to be prepared for like all of those different types of scenarios and questions and all those types of things. I'm not trying to freak anybody out of like, don't overthink it, but really have a clear, like, you know, I started this business because I had this amazing idea. It grew to this place. And now I'm ready to part with it because of X, Y, and Z, and truly like mean it. The other thing that I just a word of advice as someone who's just been through this process a couple of times is if you have an amazing business, probably don't sell it, right? Like, you know, it's one of those classic things, and I'll start my rant here. But, you know, the businesses that everyone wants to invest in and put their money in are probably the businesses that don't need any money and don't want to sell. And I have this buddy who we have this conversation every 18 months, and he's grown the business to a really meaningful size, and he's very successful. And he's like, yeah, like I'm thinking about selling it. I'm like, do you want to sell, or do you want to just fix that one part of the business that isn't, you know, exactly how you want it to operate? And he usually hires somebody and fixes it. And, you know, he's doubled or tripled his business while we've had these conversations and is doing very, very well. And so that's the other piece of like, you know, if you have such a golden goose and like, you know, this thing is so successful, really think through why you want to sell before you part with it. Because listen, once we wire you that money and once we sign those final documents, like the thing transfers ownerships and you do have to walk away or transition out over time. And I know so many founders who just have like remorse over selling their business because it's like, yeah, I took a paycheck, but the thing ended up being super successful, or I didn't find the next thing that I was really passionate about. So also like from you as the owner of the business, the thing I also love to say here is you're the greatest investor in this business up until this point. Like you've put your blood, sweat, tears, times, like you've grown this thing. And so really think through, am I ready to part with this? And what do I need for that to make the most sense to me?
Have you ever watched your Meta Ads acquisition costs double or triple overnight and then just sat there staring at it like it personally insulted you? You check your ad account metrics, you check Google Analytics, you check Shopify, you ask your agency if anything changed. You wonder, maybe just for a second, whether Mercury is in retrograde, but you find nothing. Because there's nothing to find. Meta just had a bad day. And this happens more than you'd think. The Meta Bad Day Detector by Breezeway and eCommerce Alley was built for exactly this. It pulls live data across over 50 DTC brands and tells you whether everyone got hit or whether it's actually you. It's a tool that hundreds of e-commerce brands look at every morning before looking at their ads or their numbers. And it's completely free. Visit ecommercealley.com/bad to see if it's you or if Meta just had a bad day.
I've had a lot of friends who have sold businesses and acquired businesses, and the people who acquired them, you know, like they have a theory on what, how they're going to grow it. And, you know, it's based on their experience and how it was represented. And most of the time, you know, through good due diligence, everything was represented correctly, you know, but when it's misrepresented, you know, that could be bad. On the buyer side, that's where I see the regret way more often. You know, the seller is the one who's, you know, who has the opportunity and is parting with the money. I think they just inherently do more due diligence. They think through it more versus the seller. You know, there's just emotionally so much wrapped up in a business when you're the one who built it over however many years versus acquiring it. And so I often, you know, find people where they regret selling it either because like after the fact, the deal didn't go the way they wanted, you know, or they don't know what to do at like 6 to 12 months later. They're like, I don't know what to do with myself. You know, what's next? Or like, or it often, you know, they see, to your point, how successful the business now is. And they're like, well, I could have done that. Okay. Hindsight's 2020. But even like George Lucas, how much did he get for Star Wars selling it to Disney? And even he said he, like, once he saw what they did with it, well, suddenly he's like, well, I wish I could have done it.
Right. And, you know, the paycheck, I know the paycheck is what grabs the headline. It is one of, I mean, I think when we look through deals, we have like 167 points that we look through and we usually negotiate. So maybe it's even more than that at this point. Like the headline is the number that you get is only one part of the deal. And there's so many other parts of how you built and run your business that are really crucial that, yeah, I mean, right, like that the Star Wars is probably one of the most successful examples in deal-making history for both sides, right? Like he got one of the biggest paydays ever. And I'm sure Disney has monetized that thing to the absolute hilt and made way, you know, great returns on that investment. But yeah, you know, if he could go get a time machine, maybe he wouldn't have sold. And I think that's really important to think through, like, what is important for you before you kick off that process? Because the other thing to just prepare you is usually on the when you're ready to sell your business, it's about a year long process from when you actually make the decision that like, hey, I want to, you know, depending on the size of the business, but on average, it's usually about 6 to 12 months from like, hey, I want to sell this business to the deal just closing. That's not even talking about like post deal transition of if you have to stay for a year or two, or there's a training period or anything like that. And so it is a very long, you know, this isn't I want to sell this thing and it happened, you know, what money is in my bank account tomorrow. And so spending that time before you really kick off that process of like, you know, I have that next thing in mind, that thing is way better than what I'm doing right now, and I'm ready to move on, is a major, major component of how you really determine, at least what I would recommend, is it makes everything in the process way better. And I was, you know, I can't give too much experience on when I've sold these businesses, but I'll come back in a couple of years when I do. But you know, it just makes it a much better process for you overall. And it really reduces the remorse.
For you, what's the instant deal killer? It's like, all right, we got misrepresentation, of course. A seller having the potentially wrong reason. And then of course, bad fit. What else? Where you look at it and you're just like, nope, out.
Yeah. So, I mean, we have some specific criteria on things like financials. So we're looking for businesses that had at least about 50 to 60% gross margin. That's just because in our playbook, that's what we need from just a business fundamentals to make things work. Really, a lot of key dependencies. So 80, 90% of the traffic comes from Meta. One person really runs the whole business, which is usually the person trying to sell it. And, you know, nothing is documented in the business. I can't tell you how many times I've looked through a business and be like, how do you guys structure and run ads? And I know that sounds like a very basic question, but there's actually a lot of moving components and usually multiple people, different types of resources, tools that like you actually have to have a deep, intimate understanding of that business and how that business works. My favorite line is, you know, we're all essentially selling hamburgers, but everybody's recipe and process to make a hamburger is what makes their business special. You know, if I'm going to buy your business, I want to know exactly how your hamburger is made. So those are the two or three key big ones. I would say the other really, really big one is when their financials just don't match the story that they tell. So for anybody who hasn't gone through this process before, usually the way that this process works is you create a little teaser of some key metrics. It usually has some fun name like, you know, Project Shadow or Project, I don't know, whatever clever idea, Project Fury, things like that. And then it'll be like the teaser and the overline of, hey, here's the key information. And then we essentially decide, hey, we want to learn more. You'll send over what's called a SIM. It's essentially a presentation, or if you ever raised before, it's basically just a deck. Here's the business. Here's the key information. Here's the story. If we're interested from there, we'll jump on a call. Basically, it's honestly an interview. Like we'll just go through. We have a ton of questions that we want to know about. We'll get learn more about your business. From there, if we're interested, usually we'll ask for what's called the data room. The data room is your key business, your key information. If you've ever raised money, you've probably gone through this process. Your financials, so your P&L, your balance sheet, cash flow statements, maybe some key other information that's crucial. If you're a very like IP heavy business, we'll want to look at patents. You're very busy. If you're a very like heavy ads business, we'll look at some like documentation around your ads.
A data room is like it's meant to be a secure way to share the files.
Exactly. Like it'll usually be in some sort of like, we have to get specific access. We usually sign an NDA beforehand. So, you know, we can't like go run and do anything with your business or your information after that. What, to answer your question, the other thing is like, if you've told me stuff here and your financials don't match, or there's stuff that I've looked through we've looked through your financials and it just, there's something sniffy or wrong. You know, I'll usually give person the grace of like a couple of, you know, over one email, a couple questions and maybe another call. But like, if you're telling me you have an 80% gross margin business and I cannot find a single year in your past 3-year financials of 80% gross margins, that's the exact type of thing where like, you know, it's always good to know your own numbers. Some of these metrics are very, very specific. And, you know, most people who build these successful businesses did not get an MBA in e-commerce financials and all those other data points. But, you know, if you're telling me you have an 80% gross margin business and I'm looking at it's 40% in your P&L, I haven't seen anything that drastic yet. But you know, those types of things where it's like a broad, broad miss. Because then also like when we look at your math, like if the math isn't interesting to us, we can't make all the other parts of the business and the other scaffolding work.
How often do you encounter a business where it's like, wow, this would be really successful and attractive if it weren't for the fact that to get there, they ended up saddled with debt?
you actually would be pretty surprised. So there's two camps. We do look at what are called distressed deals as well. And it's essentially the, you know, the loans that have mounted so far. You a lot of really successful D2C brands, especially the ones that have hit the market the last, I'll say 12 months, don't have that much debt on them. They're actually like, they've just, you know, maybe like a good amount of credit card debt. And, you know, usually the founders don't pay themselves very much until the thing hits pretty meaningful scale. But I would say that like okay, so there's definitely two camps. Then there's the bad debt businesses. You don't want to be in that category because we're buying it for next to nothing. You know, usually when it's called something that's called distressed, public brands go through bankruptcy or what's called Chapter 11. You know, those types of businesses, we're usually just buying it for, you know, very low amounts of money to take it out. Yeah, you do not want to have an incredible amount of debt on your business. Most of these like sub, we'll call it like usually businesses that are around less than 5 million in net profit that are sold as asset sales anyway. And in English, what that means is, let's just say that I'm buying a business from Kurt. Kurt has a cool t-shirt business, you know, fashion apparel business doing very well. I'm going to buy his assets, but he keeps his legal entity. So, you know, Kurt's T-shirts LLC stays under Kurt. I'll buy all of the things related to Kurt's t-shirt businesses as assets from it. So all the debt stays in Kurt's LLC. I'm just giving Kurt money for everything else. And, you know, you'd have to go settle the debt. Larger businesses will be.
I'm left with the shell company that has exactly. The debt. And then the things of value you take out, we transfer out, and then you pay me. And then, you know, ideally I use that to, I take care of the debt or, you know, whatever I'm going to do with it.
Yes. Hopefully you would use the proceeds from the sale to pay off your debt first. And then you essentially would be like legally and financially responsible for all of the pieces that happened while you owned the assets in the business. And you know, your Shopify site, your newsletter subscribers, your inventory, your social handles, your ad accounts, all those IP, all those things, we would just essentially purchase from you. An equity sale, which is probably what people see more in headlines, is I'm going to buy Kurt LLC and, you know, Jeremy LLC now owns Kurt LLC and all the assets and everything underneath it. In that deal, which is very, very rare for these smaller deals, yes, then like the debt on your books greatly matters because, you know, it's essentially a subtraction item from everything that we're buying for the value. You know, if you have a $10 million business, your business is worth $10 million, but you've got $2 million in debt. Well, we're only actually going to buy it for $8 million because now we have to assume your $2 million. You know, it's not always that neat, but like we're going to assume your $2 million of debt as part of our acquisition. Very, very, very rare though. Most of these deals will just be an asset sale where the owner will deal with the debt after the transaction closes.
The other way I see people get burned, you know, my grandfather-in-law is a JD CPA in Silicon Valley. And so he's seen a lot of these deals. And, you know, being a lawyer, he's seen often like, well, where they go wrong, where they go bad after the fact. And it's on, you know, earnout deals, especially where the owner stays on. Like, hey, you know, we're gonna give you 80% of the equity or whatever. Like, you're going to get a lump sum and you're going to stay on with a salary for X number of years. And then when we sell it, you're going to get a big payout. But when that time comes and the PE firm starts getting ready to sell it, magically something always went wrong and that person gets forced out. Because they want them, you know, off the cap table and capture more value for the PE firm. Is this, and I've seen it enough times now where I'm like, oh, you know, that's a thing to watch out for. For, you know, for the person selling their business, do you, should they always be trying to get that payout up front? Or can you make these milestone payments where you get equity later, you know, after like, you know, whatever, can those be made to work? Or is it just asking for a dispute?
Yeah, so I think at the moment of transaction, essentially the balance is the investors want to put as little down at the moment as possible to de-risk their investment, and the seller wants to capture as much money as possible to essentially de-risk their future, right? These transactions have this incredibly beautiful like timeline math to them where, you know, the investors worry that this thing goes to zero afterwards. And the founders worried that, like, you know, they're not going to get the future payouts if the thing, everybody's worried the thing goes to zero. It's just how you do the math around that. What I'll say is the delta between the enterprise value of the deal, like $10 million, we'll just use Kurt's Black Tea Company as an example again, right? The $10 million value of that, the delta between the $10 million that the business is worth And the amount of money that if Kurtz, the seller here, would walk away on day one is essentially the confidence that what you say and your projections of the future are accurate. So these deals where you see like big components of earnouts is because essentially what the buyer is saying is, that's great, I would love to see it, but I don't have the confidence based on what I'm seeing in today's business that I'm like, that's a guarantee payment. And so what you'll see, and just for clarification, it's very, very rare that any of these deals get done in all cash at close. Like I looked through, I did like an SMB report for QuietLight 2 years ago where we looked through hundreds of their deals. I've looked through a lot of like M&A for public companies.
QuietLight's a business broker.
Yeah, QuietLight is probably like, if you're looking to sell your business, they're definitely one of the more like best and reputable places that will essentially run the process for you. Like they are the person that you go to. They collect everything. They go find the buyers. They go set all this up, and they kind of control the sales process. And look through a bunch of this information, and essentially, like there will be some component of cash at close. Plus, there's a whole bunch of other things that you can negotiate in value, and that's also why, like I said earlier, like really clearly know what you want and what's important to you. I've heard deals where sometimes people get a Rolex instead of cash. I've also heard some deals where you know the founder takes less money, but they don't change the name of the business. Like there's a huge spectrum to what the value of the deal is. But essentially, to answer your question on earnouts, you also hear things like seller notes, which is essentially where the seller loans the acquirer's X value of the business, and then they get paid out on a loan.
Oh yeah, seller finance deals. Those are crazy.
Yeah, like those, I'd say those two are fair, or what you also hear is what you're a little bit describing is what's called an equity rollover. So we buy the assets out of Kurt LLC for $10 million. We pay Kurt $8 million and we roll 20% or $2 million. So now Kurt owns 20% of New Fashion Company. And that's part of the value that you get for $10 million worth of your business. All of those mechanics are essentially you as a seller, you need to prove to me essentially that these milestones are going to hit and that you're really, really confident. And yes, like hire a good lawyer, make sure that like you read and review the terms, because there's, it's the same thing as like venture capital, the stories of like the founder raised a bunch of money and then they sold for a big number, but the founder got nothing because they didn't read the terms and like how they got the money. And yeah, like the terms, honestly, most of the time, the terms are more important than the enterprise value number, because it's how you get paid and you should be protecting yourself, but also you need to be reasonable of if you want to go chase a really big number, and you don't have some, genre-defining business with a ton of IP, insane growth, incredibly profitable, like the acquirer will need some protections on their side as well. And so you really just need to think about like, what are your trade-offs? What are you comfortable with taking as part of that? And really understanding like, okay, if I'm taking an earnout, the last piece is really just be very, very clear with the acquirer. I think a lot of those like issues and horror stories are because the seller does not really go through like, what are the actual terms of the earnout? What is very, very clearly stated? And do we have like good communication and expectation setting? Do we have very clear milestones, goals, pieces? Because a seller note is essentially a loan, right? You're going to get like monthly payments or quarterly or annual payments back with interest. An earnout is essentially bonuses. An earnout is essentially like, if you get a $2 million earnout, when you hit these targets, we're going to essentially give you bonuses for that $2 million. And then an equity rollover is you own a part of the business. And in that, in the next part of the business, the acquirer needs to sell it for more than what you bought it for anybody to make any money.
Right. There's so many points and terms to dispute. If any of that's in a gray area, and that, years later, now suddenly you're like, oh, well, we didn't think through that. And now that becomes a thing to, negotiate on, argue about. And so having your ducks in a row and, making sure you've a good lawyer seems like a requirement here.
Accountants, lawyers, and brokers on the smaller side, bankers on the larger side, all incredibly expensive. But if you have a deal that's worth it and you structure the right terms, they pay for themselves 100 times over.
Hey, today's episode is sponsored in part by Zipify Plus. Because you've got enough to do as a business owner and marketer, the last thing you need to be worried about is optimizing your upsells. But if they're not optimized, you're leaving up to 20% of your revenue on the table every single month. So be honest, did you start a new batch of split tests on your upsells this week? Of course not. Real optimization requires constant attention, running tests, launching offers, reading reports, adjusting for sales. Your team's too busy for all that. Zipify Plus takes over your upsells completely. You get a dedicated team that builds, manages, and optimizes your upsells for you. They work with over 100 Shopify Plus stores. Their average client sees $233,000 a year in extra revenue without lifting a finger. If you can't remember the last time you updated your upsells, go to zipify.com/USP to book a free strategy call today. Their team will audit your store and show you exactly where you're leaving money on the table. No commitment required. That's zipify.com/USP because you've got enough to do without worrying about upsells too. All right, so I want to talk to you about your experience with, because you've such a great view into so many businesses, but all within the e-com space, within direct-to-consumer. And you gave a talk called D2C is Dead, and I believe the D2C is Dead, Long Live the Direct-to-Algorithm Brand. Okay, riff on this. Tell me about it.
Yeah, so the 15-minute talk in 2 minutes is the concept of go find cheap products in China, throw it up on social or search, run a bunch of ads, sell a bunch of units, and scale doesn't really work anymore. Essentially, I think the Shopify journey and like Shopify as a business has been really successful under the D2C umbrella of e-com 1.0 was essentially like eBay. E-com 2.0 was essentially Amazon SEO based businesses and like Magento, those like early, how do we get traffic off the internet, buy our product, ship something reasonably not too expensive. And then Shopify really, Shopify on the back of Meta really blew up is I can go find really cheap product, slap some branding on it, run a bunch of ads, make a lot of money. The part where that kind of imploded was D2C was supposed to be amazing because you cut out the middleman and you had great margins and there's going to be these huge profitable businesses that operated like software. As everybody has seen over the past 10 years, all that money went to Meta. And so everybody now is kind of rediscovering, 10, 15 years ago, the phrase was omnichannel. Now it's called omnibrand. I think though the major difference, if you look at the truly breakout brands, like the very, very successful ones, the Comforts, the Grooms, the True Classics, Jones Road Beauties, Liquid Deaths, it's not just that they're spending a lot of money on Meta. It's that they're figuring out how to go viral across all social channels at once, then layering on a ton of paid media on top of that to then scale. And they're not a shop, the classic question we've looked at for acquiring all these brands the last 5 years is it a Shopify business or an Amazon business? That was, that was going to determine your valuation and your business and your mechanics and your models. I think that doesn't matter anymore. These brands today are in Shopify, Amazon, retail, other marketplaces at speeds that we just never have really seen before. The classic advice 5-10 years ago was go scale up on Shopify to X number of million before you even consider another sales channel. Now it's like, okay, how do you go viral on TikTok shops or Instagram reels or YouTube? Plow as much traffic into your site as possible, but you convert 3%. You probably know this better than I do. How are you on Amazon? How are you in other places already that you're capturing all that demand and just aggressively scaling? And I think that it's really hard. It's not like an easy thing to do, but really leveraging things like TikTok shop, like YouTube influencers. If you notice most of like the $100 million, billion-dollar brands that have really grown very quickly over the last 5 years, they're leveraging Instagram reels, TikTok shops, or YouTube influencers very, very well. And then essentially also using it as a massive outsourced content creation farm where then they take what's working, plug it all into ads, and then run it in as many channels as possible. Smart. And it's this very weird, like all blitz, all channel model, which don't get me wrong, it takes a good amount of willpower to scale that quickly. You have to be really, really diligent with cash. But the brands that are absolutely blowing things out of the water have really mastered that. And, I feel like 5 years ago, it was the Dr. Squatch and we're going to go pay a creative agency. I'm not picking on them. Poopery. There was a ton of these types of business. Like, we're going to pay a creative agency to come up with this. The Harman Brothers. That was
the Harman Brothers. Raindrop.
The Harman Brothers ad, right? Everybody had a Harman Brothers ad, like the funny direct, you pay that, pay $500,000, then go spend $2 million on media on this, very highly produced social asset. I think that doesn't really work anymore. It's, for anyone who hasn't looked at Comfort, they did $500 million last year. They're on pace to do $1 billion, no outside funding. Like really one of the most impressive brands in the world. Their founder Hudson also is like very forward, shares a lot of like what they do. But essentially they just built this affiliate army on TikTok shops that constantly is promoting the heck out of their products. And then they just aggressively put paid media behind the content that's working. And so you have this very like bottom up approach to what sells. Like, you know, the brand isn't deciding how to sell their product. Essentially all these influencers are. They coach them, they do all these other things. You know, they coach them, they make them better at it once they figure out who's working. And then they pay them an incredible amount of money to scale their ads. Now, again, going back to like the financial criteria before, good margin product, you know, something that is highly scalable in multiple channels. But this new kind of brand is emerging where it's not the, we're going to go run meta ads. You know, those businesses don't really make enough money anymore. It's this, how do we be in all channels on social and retail, you know, as many as retail as possible, and then just really have aggressive momentum as a brand.
You know, I've seen a few of these work that way. And, you know, once you're on, you get on TikTok shop and, you know, you get lucky with an influencer where suddenly like they take off. And what's so interesting about that is like, okay, A, now you got UGC, you have content you can reuse. You can post that on the Shopify site. You can use that in ads, post it on social, you know, take that to other channels and use it as inspiration. You're like, hey, this worked really well, and share that with your other influencers. What I always find so fascinating is you get copycats. You get people that you didn't recruit who are not getting any affiliate cut, but like they want to ride the wave too. They want to create successful content, you know, whatever that hashtag is. And they go create something similar. And they're like, okay, well, they did it for free, but hey, let's recruit them too. And so you can quickly, it becomes a flywheel where you, what's so smart is you've outsourced that like that core content ideation, right? And figuring out what works. I've never, okay. Like I'd been thinking about this. I saw it in action, you know, especially with the golf brand we work with, Pins and Aces, where they experience this approach. And, but hearing you lay it out as like, all right, this is the, you know, the very concerted way to do it. Interesting. Okay.
Yeah. The more important piece that I think everybody misses is that it's not that it's a big piece is that you're outsourcing the ideas, but you're letting the data and the market validation of what works actually protect your media budget. Because, right, like, you know, a lot of the classic model is you pay, you know, if you spend 10 grand in ads, you spend about $700 creating the creative to then go spend in the ads. But you have to get, you like, you know, the Harman Brothers model was you paid and you guessed what worked, then spent the data on it. This is, to your point, people who, and the really interesting model today is like, none of them are influencers anymore. It's like people with like 1,000 followers or even less. So you don't have to pay them any, you know, how a lot of them are doing is you're only getting commissions. Like you're giving them commissions. So they have to prove that they can sell your product. And then you're layering on the paid media is essentially just like the, you know, whatever works, throw more fuel on the fire. And that's the real value is that you're not, you know, it's not like 5 years ago where you torched $10,000 in meta spend to figure out, you know, your 2 out of 20 ads that work. It's you already know what's working and how can I just scale that until it stops working?
It's helpful to hear it. And I think this approach, it really depends on like what your cost of goods sold is for product seeding to work. But if it's low enough and it's practical enough, this 100% is the approach I would be taking now if it wasn't something I was already trying.
Exactly. Restoration Hardware can't do this tactic, but for the normal e-com brand that, you know, it's not too expensive of a product or it's not too expensive to ship. You know, that's why you see a lot of fashion apparel, health, wellness, beauty, skincare brands do this, which I probably are most people in the space in general. I wouldn't do this with like furniture, cars, like, you know, stuff that
electronics.
You probably have to like, you know, go to more of an old school content creation model where you're bringing them to an experience. They create the stuff and figure it out. The unit economics need to be pretty cheap to ship out. You know, at this point, I think Comfort's working with something like 500,000 of these affiliates and like micro creators. And yeah, like, you know, I assume that their products are not super expensive to ship a hoodie to 500,000 people.
Yeah. And it, like, you know, there's no breakage. You just ship it. You don't worry about it breaking in transit. It definitely, like, that is kind of the cornerstone of it is, you know, the product seeding has to be practical for you. To wrap this up, I want to discuss one of your hot takes. And before we jump into this, I suspect you're a Shopify ride or die, but you've got this great piece called in which you flat out you share your opinions on Shopify Capital Loans. Tell me about, what are your feelings on Shopify Capital Loans?
Yeah. So I want to preface this with, my entire career is built around the Shopify ecosystem. Like, how I make my money is investing in Shopify apps. I have also personally just been invested in the Shopify stock for a very long time. Like, I think I bought back in 2016, 2015 timeframe. So I'm an enormous believer in Shopify. The reason I do this is because I want to call out the one thing that I think is a glaringly obvious bad decision that they're making that I hope that they correct, sort of the way that a loving family member would. So now that I prefaced all that, Shopify payday loans, like the capital that they call it, are worse than mafia loans. You would probably prefer to take money from Tony Soprano. I don't want to get too deep into the math because it's pretty boring, but you're way, way better to go deep into credit card debt than to take one of these off.
Credit card interest rates, 20 to 25%.
Most are 30% now, and it's still a better annualized interest rate on it. So to really, really quickly just talk about it, right? You put money on a normal Visa or MasterCard, your credit card, you get 30 days to pay that money back. And then after that period, they're going to charge you 20, 30% on an annualized basis, right? You'd have to carry $100,000 in a loan over a year to pay 30%. It was $30,000. Well, the other piece is that, the Visa or MasterCard or whoever your credit card provider isn't taking money out of your bank account every single time that you get cash in to pay back their loan. When you actually do the math on most of these, what are called MCAs or merchant cash advances, it actually comes out to 40% annualized interest rate. And the way that that works is that the fees that they're saying that they're charging you are being taken out of your essentially your daily sales before it even hits your bank account. Right? It's almost like sharecropper model where we're going to give you a resource and then take things out before the cash actually hits your bank. And so your two reasons why this is so dangerous. And the reason I want to call it out is I'm fine if other companies want to try this. And there were tons that tried this in 2020, 2022. All of them essentially went bankrupt or left the space. I'm fine if other companies want to do it. I feel like it's really the wrong thing for Shopify to do when they just embed it in the product, they market it everywhere, and they make it seem super safe, because these things are not. And over the years, they have taken out the personal guarantees, which are essentially if you take $100,000 out in these loans and don't pay it back, Kurt as a human being is responsible for the $100,000 payback, not Kurt's LLC. And there's a whole bunch of bankruptcy laws and other things that they're circumventing that are really dangerous there. But the other part is that they're taking it before it hits your bank account. So if you think about our modern e-commerce business, you spend a bunch of money on inventory 3 to 6 months before you sell it. Then you have to spend a bunch of money on ads to sell it. And then you eventually, somewhere in 6 months after you started to get cash in, you then immediately have to go back and do that process all over again and buy more inventory, spend more money on ads. Now, a normal loan will give you payback terms because they understand you need to put cash into your business. You need to put cash back out of your business to continue growing your business to have enough money to pay it back. These Shopify Capital loans just take the money out before the cash comes out, then pay for more inventory. And so you get in this death spiral of I take these merchant advance loans out to pay for my inventory and maybe to pay for ads. I make my sales, but then they're 7% a day or whatever the number that they're saying it is, comes out of the $100,000 that I made in sales at whatever margin, we'll say the $100,000, but then I need to put $50,000 if I have the 50% gross margin back into more inventory to scale. But now I'm losing 7%. So where is the money coming from? Mostly, almost all the time, is my profits, which is killing your cash flow as you grow. And they're very much positioning this as a growth tool and something that's amazing for your business. 4 or 5 years ago, I helped a lot of brands essentially work through these, where they actually started stalling out and either declining or going out of business because they essentially had to start discounting their product to sell the product fast enough to pay back the loan, to then buy more inventory. And it's just a death loop of really, really bad and negative behavior. If an individual wants to take these loans out because they think it's right for their business, we live in America, it is their God-given right to do that. But there's not enough customer education for someone to actually understand what they're signing up for when they do it. And I at least would like to think that the onus is on Shopify to take that education on, especially with how aggressively they market these things, because it really is, I actually do believe it is a better thing for you and your business to take on the credit card debt.
When you're in Yeah, you log into your dashboard, and it's like, it's right there as a card on the homepage. Hey, you've got, you know, X tens of thousands of dollars available to you. You know, instant payout. And they make it easy. You know, it's a Shopify product, so of course, it's very easy to use.
Right. And it's just, it's so dangerous. And it's really it's not misrepresenting, because I'm sure they have all the fine, like the fine print and the legalese, but I worked with iBeam 2 years ago, and they built a calculator to show you like what the loans of all these things actually equal. And every time you do the math of, okay, yes, I'm only paying 7% a day, 5% a day, where the numbers, it seems super small. The cost of that money is actually so far greater than that small number. And if anything happens to your business, if your meta ads stop cranking, if this product doesn't sell as well, if you have to discount another product, you now have this massive cascade of a cash issue. Because, right, it's not like a normal business where the cash is in my bank account and I can decide, do I pay the loan back to avoid interest or do I pay for more inventory? You don't have that option in this other model. They've already taken X percent over 30 days that just never even got to you, that you have the ability to go and figure out what you want to do. And it's also one of those things that I want to just make a lot of noise about it, because it's only a problem when it's too late to fix it. Like, it's not something that, like, you know, we mess up the website, ads crash, whatever. Like, those are highly fixable products. Even like a bad inventory PO, like, your business can survive that. But once you're stuck in one of these loans, it's 30, 45 days, whatever later you're paying for it. And then you have the issue over here. The other thing is, just like from our side, no other lender will really give you more money. Like, these are kind of like the junk bonds of the entire debt space. And so usually, like, when I've seen these deals, it's like, you know, these distressed deals that come from these types of loans, it's like the business has one or two of these, no higher quality level debt on it, and credit card debt. And so it's just a really dangerous cocktail mix of just things that, like, just really, like, it, you know, the interesting thing from my perspective is people like put so much time and effort into us giving them equity and maybe raising some debt at like 10 to 15% interest rates, but we'll accept a Shopify Capital loan at 40% like that. And, you know, you would never think, you wouldn't go to the SBA and be like, hey, like, you know, I'm happy to take a 20, 30% loan. There's actually in some law, there's some states, there's laws against interest rates that high. But like, everybody's just so okay taking with Shopify, because I think it's really not properly communicated of how expensive it actually is.
And, you know, with how it collects it, you could figure out the terms. You could sit down and calculate, like, well, okay, this is the actual interest expense on this. And then there's a little bit, it sounds like opportunity cost, because you're not getting the full payout. So what is the alternative to an MCA, a merchant cash advance loan?
Yeah. So with Meta getting rid of credit cards, that makes the ad part of this dicey. The one place that also, when we acquire some of these earlier businesses, like once you get to about $20, $30 million, other debt facilities open up for you that are at a higher quality that you can get out of this space. The other part I really hate about it is, you know, really preying on kind of the smaller, earlier brands. The most important thing that I think every small brand misses is their vendors are their biggest creditor. And I'll position it this way. I'm going to buy, let's say that your t-shirt brand is doing $10 million valuation, doing about 2 to 3 million in EBITDA, around like 15 million in sales. The first thing I'm going to do when I buy Kurt's business is I'm going to go to every single one of his vendors and negotiate terms. And I'd be like, hey, if we pay you net 30, we're now going to pay you net 60. We paid you, you know, whatever these terms are, we're going to extend it all out, because then I just got a 30-day loan from Kurt's t-shirt manufacturer. I just got a 30-day loan from the ad agency or the dev agency or the whoever that I need to pay these big buckets of money. And if I can turn that inventory in less time than when I need to pay those people back, I just made money. And so for anyone who ever heard, like, referred to as cash conversion cycle, I know it's a very, very boring financial term, but it's really important for you to understand in your business of every major milestone. Hey, we just did 1 million in sales. We just did 2 million in sales. We just did 5 million in sales. I call it the Moise Ali special. Because his favorite thing was, you go to all your vendors and be like, hey, we hit this amazing milestone together. What can you do for me? How can you make this cheaper? How can we get better payment terms?
And I think smaller brands just assume like they have zero leverage, but you actually do. And the bigger you become at that company, the bigger, the more important you are to that vendor. And so like, as you look through your biggest line items, it's always the either payment amounts or terms with your product sourcing vendors, your fulfillment vendors, and usually your advertising vendors as well, like your agencies and all those other things. And if you think about it, if you're starting to scale up very quickly, you're probably paying them $5,000, $10,000, $20,000 a month. That's a $100,000, you know, client for their business. Like you become very important to their business. And so working around payment terms, finding ways to be more flexible is the easiest way. Cause you know, the perfect world is I get inventory today, I sell it in under 60 days. All of my payments are 60 days. I've essentially, you know, this never works this way, but I've essentially made free money. And this is what all your retailers do. So like if you've ever seen Acquire does this amazing coverage of Costco, where you have to pay, they will pay you out on their sales in net 30 terms. They sell your items in 28 days. So you ship them your product, they sell your product, they collect all the cash for the full value of the customer, and then they pay you, right? No cash actually left Costco's bank account when you sell in Costco.
Hmm.
And so if you can start running that similar model with your vendors of, you know, I'll keep this to manufacturing to be the simplest, assuming most of them are like in China, they are, you know, they get debt way cheaper than we do. They have a lot of terms. They want to keep your business and keep your business growing. If you can, you know, get your product 60 days out, you sell your product, you know, and you have 60 day payment terms. As long as you sell your product for less than 60 days, you have the cash now to grow faster. It will never work out perfectly with all your vendors, but you want to do this in as many places as possible of essentially limiting as much as possible the cash out of your business before the cash comes into your business. And all these like incredibly fast growing brands that probably most of the people in the space are looking to and idolizing, they've actually mastered this piece way more than they raised a bunch of money or they took on a bunch of debt. The other piece also in this same component is a lot of times, depending on if your business is growing very well, your manufacturer, your 3PL will also either loan you money or invest in your business. Like I can't tell you how
that was an option.
Yeah, I can't tell you how many successful brands were just like, yeah, we needed a $100,000 line of credit and we asked our manufacturer and our manufacturer extended us a $100,000 line of credit on top of our current like payment term. Hmm. Like, you know, don't be a, like a vulture and like take advantage of everybody, but create mutually beneficial, you know, relationships with all of your vendors. You could essentially fund your business another cycle by just getting better payment terms on either pricing or on, you know, there's also for that example, you could pay your vendor more, but have better payment terms, right? If you have really, this is why we like really high gross margin businesses. If I have 80% gross margin and I need another 30, 60 days, I might pay them and my gross margin comes down to 75%. So they get paid 5% more, but now I've just bought myself 2 months.
This is really good advice.
It's really understanding, you know, you can do this in any business. Like we do this at Coco, like depending on the vendor, like we'll pay different payment terms. And sometimes you pay a little more, sometimes you pay less. Like it's all in the negotiation. Ideally, you pay the same amount. You just have better payment terms. And yeah, you essentially, you buy yourself a ton of time and a ton of growth. And every successful business has figured this metric out. It's always super boring. Everybody's eyes glaze over. But it's the most important thing if you want to grow and grow quickly without taking on a ton of capital in it.
Well, I'm glad I asked and I'm glad you brought it up. Because it's good advice, but you know, it's the kind of thing, it's not exciting, it's not sexy, it's not AI, right? It, you know, that, so it doesn't get talked about, you know, not in these shows and in these spaces, because it's just not going to sell as well and get as many eyeballs. But like, that's, you know, the real meat of a business is that cash flow.
True. I need to build a Claude code or like some AI agent that does this for brands and everybody will find it really, I mean, anybody could, like you could just put in the, whatever your preferred LLM is. Hey, here, you know, here's my latest invoice. How can I negotiate better payment terms? And it probably actually will spit out something pretty good. So there's your AI spin for everybody.
There you go.
It's a sexy part of the
pie. It doesn't even have to be hard. We can get an AI to do, you know, half the work for us. So, okay, going back to your acquisitions, are you still looking for, you know, your next perfect acquisition? You got Coco, you like it. What else are we on the hunt for?
Yeah, so we're still looking for that $10 to $100 million brand. I actually have like two or three deals to look through this week. So we're still looking for that. And then we're also looking for other acquisitions that would make sense to pair with Coco. So a very, very common playbook that you'll see in this space is, you know, we buy one business. What's another business that makes, you know, 1 + 1 = 3? Very, very hard to do. Most people don't do it very well. But if we can keep buying more other software businesses that make sense and we can scale up, that's also something that we're very interested in as well.
That's, yeah, I think that's the play a lot of people make. And then it's just, you know, it's harder than anyone expects to be able to merge two businesses and like get the synergy out of it that way.
Yeah, especially in this space where, at least on the consumer side, so many brands are so unique that it's almost like it's almost impossible to have synergy with another company. Like they're very successful because they've done something incredibly unique and different. On the software side, it's a little bit different because we can offer multiple services to the same client base. But yeah, it's a very interesting challenge. And, you know, I'm, hopefully I don't have to look through another 500 before we acquire our next one. But yeah, we're always on the hunt looking for our next deal.
So you've got this great newsletter. Where could people sign up for it?
Yeah. So the best place to get everything, Jeremy, if you're still listening this far into the podcast and it's still interesting, my LinkedIn is the best place. So Jeremy Horowitz, Horowitz. The link to my newsletter, I post content daily about something e-com related and kind of in this space, as well as Coco and everything else that I'm working on.
All right. Jeremy Horowitz, follow him on LinkedIn. Jeremy, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me on.
Hey, before you go, I was hoping you would check out our new app, Promo Party Pro. It is what I want to be the single best, easiest way to run a free gift with purchase promo on Shopify. We just put it live in the App Store. We've got less than 50 users. We want your feedback. So if you need to run a free gift with purchase promo in the near future, install it, try it. There's a live chat. I check that all the time. And so if you have any issues at all, you know, or any suggestions on how we can make it even easier to use, let us know. We're happy to help. If you want to try it, search Promo Party in the App Store. Promo Party Pro is the app. Give it a shot. It's got a free trial. Thanks.